Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show for the last 6 years, and also founder of Yes to Life, the UK's integrative cancer care charity. Each week on the show, I get to talk to experts around the world about developments that are pushing the boundaries of integrative medicine for cancer, increasing our knowledge and understanding, and thereby improving the experience and outcomes of those with cancer. This week, I shall be speaking about cannabis medicines, a hotbed of speculation as to its potential in cancer care, and an approach that's been struggling to make its way from relegation as an illegal drug across into mainstream use. I'm speaking to Dr. Simon Erridge, someone who's spearheading an initiative to do just that, to provide an accessible route to legal cannabis use for a range of medical situations. Hi, Simon. Welcome to the Yes to Life show.
Hi, good morning, Robin. Thank you for having me on.
So today we're going to be talking about access to and the research behind cannabis medicines. Before we get stuck into that, I wonder if you'd introduce yourself and the company you work for.
Yeah, of course. So I'm Dr. Simon Erridge. I work for Sapphire Medical Clinics, and my background is I'm a junior doctor in the NHS, and I'm also a researcher at Imperial College London. But my role with the clinics is as their head of patient access and head of research as well.
Okay, fantastic. So just to be clear then, Sapphire Medical Clinics is a specialised cannabis clinic, and it's a virtual service as well, correct?
Yes, so since 2019, shortly after the legislation change in 2018, we set up because we sort of understood that there was a real, despite the legislation change, it was going to be difficult for people to access medical cannabis, and essentially we set up this bespoke platform for accessing medical cannabis. And we weren't always virtual, that was never the intention, but with COVID in 2020, we transitioned very quickly to virtual, and actually it's been really helpful in being able to reach people right across the UK rather than being based in different city centres around the country.
So it's interesting how these things that happen out of necessity sometimes turn out to be the best. Yeah. So do you want to say a little bit about the team that you've got at Sapphire?
Yeah, so as I said, in 2019 we were set up by a few co-founders. I was one of the original team that helped set it up alongside Dr. Michael Sodergren, who is a surgeon and also a researcher at Imperial College, and that's how we know one another. And then also another surgical colleague, Dr. Ross Coomer. And then we've sort of quickly expanded and brought on a multidisciplinary team of different doctors who specialize in a number of conditions. So for instance, our medical director, Dr. Mike Platt, he's a specialist in chronic pain and has been one of the leading figures in London pain services for a number of years, in addition to a number of other specialists in different fields such as neurology, general medicine, psychiatry, as well as paediatrics as well.
So you've got a lot of skills in-house. Okay, so the clinic was set up to address some particular problems surrounding medical cannabis. Do you want to explain what the problems are and how Sapphire seeks to address them?
Yes, so as people may or may not be aware, it was in November 2018 where there was the legislation change, which meant that medical cannabis could then be prescribed. There are a number of barriers, though, in terms of being able to be prescribed medical cannabis in the UK. First of all, you need to have a diagnosis of your condition. Secondly, you need to have tried previous first-line licensed therapies. And then in addition to that, you need to be seen by a specialist in your condition and have the decision to prescribe medical cannabis ratified by a multidisciplinary team, the type of team that we've got set up at Sapphire. And it really became very clear in early 2019 that the NHS wasn't set up in order to be able to provide this kind of service. And that's why we really were the first clinic to set up in terms of helping to drive forward access to medical cannabis in the UK. But I think moving on beyond that early initial stage is actually there are a number of different initiatives that need to happen and are ongoing in terms of being able to make people aware of access to medical cannabis through education, through coming on podcasts like this and putting on our own educational events, whether that be for patients or for the general public or for healthcare professionals. But I think the most important thing is trying to drive the research forward in the UK itself. The thing that's going to help people appropriately access medical cannabis in the UK is making sure that the right research is placed in front of policymakers and guideline decision makers in order to be able to make the decision that yes, this is appropriate for the NHS or it's not appropriate for the NHS. And I think that's the real trouble at the moment is it's not that there is evidence that says this is an inappropriate medicine for the NHS. It's just that the evidence that we have is not of a sufficient standard to be able to either say, you know, this should be considered as a first line treatment on the NHS or not.
Yeah. So that thing about public awareness is interesting, isn't it? Because I think the thing that's mainly got through to the public is the mixture of these sort of tragic stories of parents trying to get what's a cheap and reasonable and effective treatment for their children for various conditions and endless stumbling blocks, and then it finally being passed as being okay, and then, well, nobody's going to prescribe it then. I mean, it's just like endless hurdles. And so in a way, you've actually sought to address those hurdles by setting up the right set of conditions to be able to prescribe it and get past the stumbling blocks, do you?
Yeah, no, 100%. And I think when you mention about the children with epilepsy, I think that's very true. And you know, actually, that was the reason why the legislation change came around. But also about that awareness point is I think that though, you know, over 50% of the patients treated with medical cannabis in the UK are those with chronic pain. And then the next highest proportion are those with anxiety disorders. And right. And actually, I think that a lot of people just aren't aware that, you know, if they wanted this to be an option for them, that it is there and available, because a lot of the narrative, and for the right reasons, is around the children with epilepsy disorders. Right. But I think it's important for people to be aware that, you know, that actually the most prescribing that happens in the UK is for other conditions beside that.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, the field we're talking about today, cancer, is one of those. So lots of opportunities there. So we're going to go into all of those. Anyway, very interesting. And I think, you know, one of the unfortunate effects of all the legislation about it has been, of course, that most of the traffic for use of cannabis medicines within cancer has been underground, basically, and driven there by the law. And I think, awareness that they could actually be just getting it as a prescription medicine is probably very low. I think the stories about not being able to get it are more prevalent than the ones about being able to get it. So this is a good news story that you're telling today. Okay, so I wonder if you tell us who's eligible for treatment by the clinic, particularly with relation to cancer, of course. That's of most interest.
Yeah, of course. So the criteria for treatment with cannabis is that you need a diagnosis, and obviously those people with cancer will invariably meet that criteria anyway.
Okay.
And then the next steps would be to have tried first-line licensed therapies. And obviously, with respect to cancer, this is looking at symptoms either caused by the cancer or secondary to treatment related to the cancer. So that might be you know, nausea and vomiting caused by chemotherapy. It could be peripheral nerve pain caused by chemotherapy. It could be nausea and vomiting, you know, just caused by the cancer in and of itself. And if individuals have tried first line licensed therapies and haven't achieved sufficient clinical response to those, then that's when they would meet sort of the legal threshold to be able to be considered for medical cannabis. And then if they were to come to a clinic like Sapphire, they would have a consultation with a with a specialist who could go through the options for them and see whether actually is medical cannabis specifically right for that individual. And then mm-hmm. the process from there is if you know, between the doctor and patient, you decide that medical cannabis is the right option. They take that away, discuss it with their colleagues, ratify that decision. And then actually the prescription is sent to the pharmacy, and then the medications are actually couriered to their front door.
Mm. Fantastic. All right. So just say, okay, I've got over all the basic hurdles. I'm the right person to contact the clinic. What do I expect?
Yeah. So I think the thing to expect is that firstly, that you're going to have online consultations throughout, and actually what we do in addition to our consultations is send people patient reported outcome measures so that we're constantly monitoring how you're getting on with treatment, how things are changing for you. So those things are specific to the symptoms that you are experiencing. So if it's chronic pain, you'll get questionnaires about chronic pain to see how you're getting on in between visits. With the medical cannabis, the treatment pathway is to start at a low dose and then gradually titrate it up over time. So as you're doing that, you have much more regular appointments at the beginning. So obviously you have your first appointment, and then we tend to book in people about a month after that, because that's sort of the most key time in terms of titrating up their dose. And then we tend to see them 2 months following that. So at the 3 month time period. And by that point, generally most people tend to be at a fairly stable dose of their medication. And then we would see them every 3 months thereafter to ensure how they're getting on with their treatment, if things need to change, if, you know, for whatever reasons. Everything is obviously dynamic when it comes to health and well-being. That's what people should expect.
Yeah. Okay. And so the level of the dosage that they are given is presumably you're just increasing it to the point at which it starts to be effective, which is different for each person.
Yeah, it's really different. And it's really interesting in terms of what is an effective dose for some people. Some people seem to react to positively and negatively to small doses, whereas other people need really large doses. And essentially the point of the titration is to gradually build things up so that you're not experiencing those adverse events until you reach you know, a stable dose whereby you are gaining the maximum benefit from the medication. Mm.
So as with most things in the world, it's not for everyone though, is it? So what sort of proportion of the people that you help do you experience that you're actually, it is helpful for? I mean, this is going to have to be a fairly broad brush answer, I appreciate, but I'm just interested to know.
Yeah, no, 100%. It's not a panacea. It's not going to work for everybody. What we do have from the research we've done in the clinics is that sort of across all the patients that we see, looking specifically at the symptoms of chronic pain and anxiety and nausea and vomiting, things like that. And this includes patients without cancer as well as cancer. Yeah. So it's a bit conflated there, is that on the whole, on average, there is an improvement overall if you take everyone into account. When you start to sort of split it up as to who is gaining benefit, again, it's a bit more difficult, but for most conditions, it's generally above 50%, which is really high. Interesting, which is especially because if you consider that the patients that we see have to have tried first line therapies prior to this. So these are patients really who have otherwise, you know, exhausted prior treatment options for them, and this is something that they're considering above and beyond that. So to actually have that kind of response rate in some ways is quite shocking, but also quite nice, of course.
Yeah.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with ZeroZilchZip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit ZeroZilchZip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip. Because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Interesting. So, I kind of get the impression that it's a systemic response to this natural product that we might be looking at. I'm interested to explore this. I'm saying if cannabis medicines work for you, then they're quite likely to work for any of the conditions that you might want to treat them for. Would that be true, or is it very specific to condition?
So obviously it would need to be for specific conditions where we know that there's some clinical evidence that medical cannabis may work for. But I think the key thing about cannabis is that we have our own, the body has its own cannabinoid system, and that is what the main compounds from the cannabis plant, cannabidiol or CBD and tetrahydrocannabinol, THC, are interacting with. And the role of this own cannabinoid system is to regulate. It's a regulatory system. So what it does is it either dampens down or enhances the production of transmitters in the brain between different nerves and neurons. And so actually from a lot of the preclinical studies, so before human work, we know that it has a role in emotional processing and mood, and from that point of view. But then also we have seen that it has effects on peripheral receptors as well, because the cannabinoid system is not just something that is in the brain and the spinal cord. It's present throughout most bodily tissues. So, you know, it has an effect on receptors in the guts, which may be relevant for people who have gut issues. It also has receptors on nerve pain fibers, you know, right the way down to your fingertips and toes. Mm. So there is a real, you know, potential for ubiquitous use. And I think that's the interesting thing about cannabis, is I can't think of a parallel almost in modern medicine where a medication is being prescribed for so many conditions at the same time. Right. Yeah. So I think that speaks to sort of the breadth of that cannabinoid system.
Yeah, very interesting. And is there any kind of scientific theory as to why it works for some people and not others?
I don't think we have that level of detail. We are starting to see that there are generally some differences between sexes, so between people born male or female, in terms of their response to cannabis. And actually, women tend to have higher number of cannabinoid receptors that respond to. So actually, they tend to respond to lower doses than men. Men tend to need higher doses. That's quite an interesting finding, and that's something that's continuing to sort of show through in the literature. But beyond that, I don't think we have any clear idea as to why some people may respond to therapy whilst others may not.
Okay, so I'd like to go on to talk a bit about the detail of the conditions you help people with cancer with. So, you know, you've already mentioned lots of things. Can we just talk a little bit about the key issues that people are facing that they come along to the clinic for help with, that you feel you're able to help with in many cases, and exactly how much of an effect you're able to achieve?
Yeah, of course. So I think that the main symptom related to cancer that we see and have shown people to have, some people to have benefit from in the clinic, is related to pain. Right. And that is by and large peripheral neuropathies secondary to chemotherapies, but then also you know, related to the cancer in and of itself, and that's where we've generally seen some of the greatest effects within the patients that we see at the clinic. The next group is maybe this is not directly cancer related, but is people with you know, psychological conditions secondary to either the, you know, having a diagnosis of cancer or going through the treatment of cancer, whether that be, you know, they develop an anxiety disorder, or, you know, even all the way up to post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, it's a, it can be a really tough time for people.
Well, those are two real big ones you've mentioned already. I mean, obviously pain can completely destroy somebody's life, even if their cancer's under control. If they're in pain every day, it makes life not worth living. And, you know, there are a lot of problems with conventional pain medication, as we now know. Good for a short period, but so this is, you know, it's potentially a very significant contribution to an important area of healthcare if it can actually provide significant pain control. So just to be clear, peripheral neuropathy that you mentioned there, this is damage to the nerves right at the ends of the fingers and toes, at the extremities. And if it's working to manage that discomfort of that, is it actually affecting repairs, or is it just making it feel better?
So I think it's maybe a combination. I don't think it's repairing so much, as you say, but what it is having an effect in is both at the peripheral nerves that have been affected by the chemotherapy, but then also centrally in the spinal cord and in the brain, in the way that those pain transmissions are then relayed up to the brain and then how someone interprets that pain sensation. So I think it's having a dual effect. I myself and some colleagues were at a conference last week in Galway, Ireland, which was the International Cannabinoid Research Society conference, and there are some interesting preclinical work that's now trying to move into the clinical realm, which is looking at medical cannabis and then using that alongside, like, during chemotherapy treatment to see if it has a role in prevention.
Protection.
However, that's too preliminary in order to be able to give any sort of solid clinical recommendation, but the preclinical work is interesting and obviously look forward to seeing the outcomes from that in the hopefully not too distant future.
I mean, that would be absolutely brilliant if you could prevent it in the first place, because it's just a side effect, a necessary evil going with the treatment. So, yeah, definitely be great. Also on the pain side, how about the legendary awful things to live with, like bone pain? Can it help with things like that?
Yeah, it really can do. And, you know, I think there are a number of different pain etiologies that we've seen benefits in. And what I think is really interesting, and what we've tried to tease out is, obviously, pain has such a wide ranging effect in terms of affecting mood, mobility, sleep. And part of what we think, and some work that we're trying to do at the moment, is how can, if you can break that cycle. And actually, we looked at patients who had pain and also a diagnosis of anxiety. And actually, those people who also have anxiety had a greater benefit from being prescribed medical cannabis compared to those without anxiety. Both groups had an improvement in the severity of their pain and its interference in day-to-day life, but those people with anxiety had an even greater effect. And so what we think is that medical cannabis is not only having effects sort of, you know, directly on bone pain or neuropathic pain, it's also helping to break that cycle of, you know, significant pain, which reduces your mobility, so you stay inside indoors more, so it reduces your mood, and then you're going in around in a bit of a cycle. So actually trying to help viral spiral. Yeah. So if we can try and break that, that's like a really interesting aspect that we've done some work into.
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken to people on the show about managing consistent pain, and of course the mental side of it is incredibly important, so I can well see how that would happen. Very interesting. On to, you were talking about the potential for it in helping with things like anxiety or even PTSD. We've got a whole conference dedicated to the role of the mind and the emotions and the spirit in treatment through cancer, and that's coming up in September. So it's an area that's growing in the amount of attention it's getting quite rapidly, I find, all of a sudden, which I'm very pleased about, because it's tended to be sidelined. It's not that important, but I think it's very important to patients. So I'm interested to hear that cannabis is being looked at in this way. In fact, that's maybe the way in which it's been used the most amongst the public, is in dealing with the mental challenges and emotional challenges of facing an existential crisis like cancer. So do you want to say a little bit more about the ways in which you find you're able to help?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think you're very right. And actually, we know from some YouGov data that in 2019, so after the legislation change came about, 1.4 million people were accessing illicit cannabis to treat their medical conditions, and mental health problems were a huge part of that. So I think you're definitely right there. With respect to medical cannabis and how, what we've seen when we've been prescribing it for anxiety, and in some of the studies that we've done, we've shown that when patients start off their treatment, they're normally already being prescribed antidepressants. They've been through cognitive behavioral therapy or other talking therapies. And then at that point, on average, they tend to be at a moderate level of generalized anxiety. And then within 1 month of treatment and then following that up to 12 months, we've seen that that reduces down to a mild level of anxiety. So we're quite confident that not only are we, you know, we're satisfying our mathematical criteria that there's been some sort of effect, we know that there's a, you know, a genuine human effect in terms of the anxiety levels that those patients are reporting, which is really nice to see. And then we discussed briefly a little bit about post-traumatic stress disorder, and again, we've got smaller numbers, so we haven't been able to follow that up as long as up to 12 months, but up to 6 months, we've again seen really similar findings in terms of its effects. I think the next step for us is that, I think, you know, some of the listeners may be thinking that cannabis sometimes causes anxiety or other mental health problems, and what I think would be nice to kind of tease out is those people who perhaps are really respondent to cannabis from a point of view of relieving their anxiety, and those people who actually it tends to induce anxiety on. I think that's our next step in trying to tease it out, but certainly the results that we've seen are largely positive in with regards to people who have anxiety and improving those levels.
Mm-hmm. That's good to hear. Mm. Out of interest, do you have any information regarding how starting on a cannabis medicine affects other medication? There's obviously poor side effects from taking an antidepressant. Are people able to stop taking them?
Yes. So we've done a little bit of work on this, because we ask patients ask them to submit what medication they're taking at baseline for their clinical consultation, and then we ask them to record and or their doctor can record when these change throughout treatment. So we've seen with antidepressants, it's quite difficult because they don't always match up exactly. You know, if people change or switch or change dose, there's no real way of standardizing that. But we generally do see that people reduce the number of antidepressants that they are taking. But sort of skipping back to chronic pain for a second, with opioid medications, for instance, there's a really easy way of grouping them all together and the dose. And we do see, you know, a significant reduction in the overall amount of opioids that people are taking during the course of therapy. So yeah, there definitely is some effects in terms of the other medications that are being prescribed as a result of this.
Well, that has to be a good thing with opioids.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchzip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchzip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip. Because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And when you're looking at it as a obviously, if you're treating pain, and then, well, it's as long as you have the pain. But from the point of view of anxiety, is it seen as a sort of permanent or very long-term medication, or does it actually produce genuine reduction in anxiety independent of taking it?
I think this is our next step in terms of figuring things out. I think it's as it's used in every day-to-day clinical practice, it's been such a short period of time since 2019 for us to be able to say exactly, you know, once a person is, you know, reached almost, you know, remission from their anxiety, then how do we then start to reduce their dose? This is something that our clinicians have talked about, and we've set up a, you know, a regimen to help people reduce down their dose and then come off. But I don't think we have really clear data as to sort of the long-term success of that, just because medical cannabis has been a therapy for such a short period of time now.
Right. Okay. Well, it's an interesting territory. Lots to find out, obviously, but lots of potential. Can we just go back to the different conditions that you're helping with? There's a few we haven't covered yet, I'm sure, like nausea you've mentioned, both chemo-induced and cancer-induced. So do you want to say a little about that?
Yeah, I think this is obviously, this is one thing within medical cannabis that deviates slightly from everything else, in that there is a licensed cannabis-based product for the treatment of nausea and vomiting caused by chemotherapy in the UK. So in addition, so apart from all those other medical cannabis things that are prescribed, they're typically classified as unlicensed medicines, but there actually is a medication that's gone through the licensing process specifically for this. So, you know, we have slightly longer term data about its efficacy, and that is a pure sort of tetrahydrocannabinol THC based compound for the treatment of chemotherapy induced nausea and vomiting.
So that's a first line response then?
So it could be used, but in first line response, the NICE, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, suggests that it's more of a sort of second line therapy compared to some of the other antiemetics that are commonly used sort of in everyday nausea and vomiting, like cetirizine and things like this. But but you know, the fact that, that there already is that licensed therapy gives us a much greater solid foundation upon which to use sort of these other therapies. And I think what we are now able to do, obviously, with the unlicensed therapies is consider the addition of cannabidiol into the mix with tetrahydrocannabinol. And we know from a number of studies now that cannabidiol can actually help reduce some of the adverse events or the side effects from THC, and actually can modulate some of the clinical effects. CBD has shown some positive anti-inflammatory effects, both preclinically and in humans as well. So being able to introduce that alongside this known quantity is really interesting, and again the results have been largely positive.
So many variables, right? the balance of these two, the THC and the CBD, all the different patients, how it affects them, the dosages are, you know, it's a minefield of things to find out, really. Maybe we better say a quick word about the other side, the side effects and safety of cannabis medicines themselves, just so that people are in the picture.
Yeah, no, 100%. So this is something that we do. We collect adverse events right throughout treatment and prompt people with emails, text messages to say, make sure you tell us if you have any adverse events. And they go through that every clinical follow-up as well. So we have quite a good repository of the reported adverse events, and generally these are mild to moderate, and generally they are self-remitting in that it generally tends to be early on in treatment that patients experience side effects, and as they go on with time and as they build up some tolerance to those adverse events, they tend to remit. That's not always the case, but generally that's what we've seen. We've had, very few severe adverse reactions to medical cannabis, which is really fortunate. And I guess the one thing that people are always concerned about is the risk of psychosis. I think that's something that's put out in the media quite a lot with respect to illicit cannabis, at least. And actually, there have been a few episodes of psychosis, but actually considering they tend to be in individuals who have a really high burden of mental health problems anyway. And our psychiatrists generally are of the impression that we've had a lower rate of psychosis within that population than they would generally expect to see if they were or were not prescribed medical cannabis. That appears to be a non-medical cannabis related effect, but obviously we can't 100% rule that out, so we obviously report it openly and honestly, I think in summary the take-home message is that the majority of adverse events that we see are mild to moderate and are self-remitting.
Well, that's a very good message. So basically not that much to worry about, no danger of damage basically, and you're also saying that long-term use is not an issue in the way that it is with opioids, for example.
Yeah, as far as we can see, there doesn't appear to be sort of significant long-term effects. I think the one caveat to that, and which we need more data, is with respect to in children. But the only prescribing really that we're doing in children is for those with treatment resistant epilepsy, and you know there is a very much known effect on their long term cognitive as well as general physical health of having 100 plus seizures a day, and so it's kind of balancing the unknown risk of the potential effects on the developing brain of medical cannabis versus the known risks of that, that's a challenging question, but I think we're on the right side of that.
All right. So one of the most exciting aspects of your setup there at SAFAR, I looked at from where I stand, seeing things from the patient perspective, is that built into your service is a real world data trial. So just to be clear, real world refers to the fact you're collecting data from actual cancer patients as opposed to a carefully chosen cohort of people selected ostensibly to remove bias, but actually removing the result from the real world entirely at the same time, in my opinion. Anyway, do you want to tell us about the trial and what you're hoping to achieve?
Yeah, of course. I think you're 100% right in that the randomized controlled trials do tend to be really select cohorts, and what we're hoping to do is show the effects on patients in day-to-day life. I think randomized controlled trials are 100% necessary. That's a given, but also I think these are also really important studies to do. And so what we're doing is I mentioned briefly at the beginning that we send patients these survey questions. Actually, they're validated questionnaires that are specific, and they map accordingly to randomized controlled trials. You know, these are the measures that people are using in randomized controlled trials. And we ask patients to complete them prior to treatment at 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, and every 6 months thereafter, and monitor how those levels change. And actually, one of the really nice things I think that we've been able to do over the past year is not only collect that data anonymously and then analyze it, but also give patients back their scores, and so let them see exactly, you know, what that trend has been over time, which is quite nice. And then, so yeah, we've been using that across a number of the conditions that we see in order to be able to track the trends across treatment, and that's been, you know, really invaluable in terms of building up the evidence base for medical cannabis, not only because, you know, I think there's real value to real world evidence, but particularly medical cannabis. You mentioned some of the complexities around the different compounds, the doses, different conditions. It's a challenging therapeutic in which to conduct randomized controlled trials, because it would be very difficult to take one oil for one condition and then say medical cannabis does or does not work off the basis of one randomized controlled trial. So actually, in addition to this providing it in and of itself its own data, what we think it's really useful for is now what we're able to do with bigger numbers is say, okay, let's look at this specific medical cannabis product for this specific condition. What are the outcomes of that? And then use that to help inform randomized controlled trials, because, you know, randomized controlled trials are very necessary in terms of being able to license medications and make them more easily accessible through the NHS. That's the gold standard that doctors and guideline makers are looking for. So if we can use that to say to people who are funding these trials, to say, look, we've got some really good signals that this is the, if you're going to do a randomized controlled trial, this is the one you want to take because it's most likely to be successful. That's really helpful in terms of, you know, getting the most bang for your buck with respect to research, which can be very expensive.
Yeah, very important. Just based on retrospective data, you can actually recommend which areas to do a trial in. Very interesting. An important point is, I think I'm correct in saying, you offer reduced appointment costs to people for joining the trial.
Yeah, no, very true. So I think it's really important that people are recognised for their contributions to research. And so, yeah, we obviously it's a private clinic, so there has to be, unfortunately, some associated costs, but we've reduced down the appointment fees to £50 per appointment for those people who contribute to the real world evidence. And, you know, if you consider trying to get a 40 plus minute appointment with a pain specialist or a psychiatrist, I think £50 is not a bad deal.
Not bad at all. Yeah, and while we're talking about money, I want to let listeners know that there is an impressively transparent pricing section on your website. I think it's very helpful for patients.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I just wanted to round up by saying it's really exciting how kind of these new initiatives are popping up these days to develop routes around these roadblocks that our medical and legal systems seem to throw up all the time, which, you know, this is what we read in the newspaper headlines, the tragedies that these cause. Given the best case scenario, what do you hope to achieve in the next 5 years through your initiative?
Yeah, I think that's really important, Robin. And what I hope is that we are playing at least our role in in developing the evidence base which can help inform access through the NHS. I think we as a clinic operate out of necessity rather than, sort of a traditional model whereby the NHS exists for the vast majority of patients, and then people, opt to go privately if they have the resources. I would really like to see that we play our role in helping some of our own patients now being able to access therapy through the NHS in the future. Mm. And, hopefully that's within the next 5 years. But unfortunately your guess is as good as mine as to when that may happen. But that's definitely my hope.
Well, it's great because you're providing something now for people, which is fantastic. But also, by the way you're approaching it, you're actually encouraging the adoption by the NHS in the longer term. So both fantastic aims. So that's about it for time. So thanks so much for telling us about all your plans of expanding the use of cannabis medicines, Simon. I'm sure listeners will be really heartened to hear that you're building this, the potential of these medicines as a resource for patients.
Great. Thank you very much for having me, Robin.
Okay. Bye-bye then, Simon.
Have a good day. Cheers.
A really interesting and creative initiative. Do take a look at sapphireclinics.com to find out more. And remember, Sapphire has two P's, SAPPHIRE. I mentioned our annual conference. If you're interested to know more or to pick up a great early bird price to attend, then go to yestolife.org.uk and click the button that's on the rotating banner at the top of the homepage advertising the event. This will take you to the dedicated website for the conference. Lovely to have you listen today. I'll be back again next week as usual, so it'll be great if you can join me again for another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.